Hey y'all, I want to give a quick warning that this episode includes depiction of sexual abuse.
I'm telling you this story, but I never, ever, ever, ever have to relive that story again. And so the pain that I used to feel with it was because I was still so connected to the smell around me when it happened. So that I, like, when that smell, if I was walking in the street, it would take me right back to it.
Hello there, I'm Yonka Kamara. Welcome to Kume Turning Point Diaries, where we share stories of critical moments in our personal and professional lives. This week, we explore the topic of healing with Dr. Workia Duncan. Workia is a professional educator, wife, and mom of four. In our conversation, she shares the most intimate, personal, and complicated details of her dual upbringing in America and Liberia, which shaped the compassionate person she is today. Workia also opens up about a sensitive yet important topic, sexual abuse. With great courage, she walks us through the path of wrestling with shame, guilt, and her Christian faith. Workia inspires us with her vulnerability and persistent strength. Join us as we dive into her journey to self-love and acceptance. Hello, Workia. Welcome to Kume Turning Point Diaries.
Good morning, Yelka. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm so excited to have you. I want you to introduce yourself in your own words. So tell us a little bit about you, where you're from, and that kind of stuff.
So anytime someone says where you're from, I'm like, that's not as easy of a question because I was born in Flushing, New York. And funny story, my husband was born in the same hospital before, like, clearly he's older than I am, but he was born there as well. But we didn't know that until like years after. So that was funny. So yeah, I was born in Flushing, New York, but then like pretty much soon after that, my mom was like, I don't really know how to take care of a baby. So let me send you to Liberia to my mom who can do that. And so there's a part of me that feels more Liberian than anything else, even though when I'm with my Liberian family, they're like, you are so American. So that for me, that's that walking dual identities. But I think that that type of duality settles me and steadies me in a way, because like during this time, my kids had already understood that there would be a change in how we exist, but that because of how hopefully we could have used technology, we could still remain connected in certain ways. And if that meant that we would cook Liberian food together in order to keep that alive, we would, we have an ancestral altar that has a lot of family members' pictures on it. And that became more important now because as of yesterday, that it's now 22 people I know that have passed from COVID. And so learning just how to keep your mind together and using like our African spiritual ways to do that and how to ask for help and know that the expectation is that family helps family. So that's what we've been doing. So for me, like, that's where I'm from.
I'm so sorry about your loss. I know like all of us have been affected in different ways, impacted by this crisis. Some of us have lost a lot of folks, you know, so I'm so sorry to hear that. You said your mother sent you to Liberia. Was your mom a single mom or how was that?
So the story that I'm told, and I kind of love this story in a weird, weird way, even though it ended up that my mom did become a single parent, but she was married. I came along in that way because she grew up in an Episcopalian household and a very conservative Episcopalian household. So there was like, first comes love, then comes marriage, then comes Workia and a baby carriage. But there was never a symbiotic love between her and my father. They met at Mount Sinai Hospital in Manhattan. He was doing genetics work and she was working with teen moms. And she heard him speaking and she was like, first I knew he wasn't a Black American, but then he was talking to several people in different languages. And she was, oh my God, this man is amazing. Cause that whole language. And then she was like, his jawline was just beautiful. And he's a dark brown. And he was, he's from Côte d'Ivoire. So she was like, this is the perfect person. Except that she was raised to want to have that type of person in her life. But in her own spirit, she never, ever wanted to be married, never wanted to have children. She wanted to just travel and do her own thing. Somehow they got together and pretty quickly she realized, this marriage thing was more like we had a nice wedding, but there was no relationship or friendship on which to build a marriage. And so she would go, like she told him, you know, I don't know how to take care of a child. And he was like, we could get a babysitter. And she's like, I don't know the babysitter. I know my mom. And so he was always fighting to try to make her into what he thought she would become after marriage. And she was always saying, I don't care that marriage happened. This is who I am. And this is who I'm going to be. And so roundabout, I want to say when I was 3 years old, the story goes that he told her, if you go back to Liberia and because she would go every other month and he would go every now and again, but he was like, if you go back to Liberia for whatever reason, when you come back, I won't be here. She pretty much was like, bet. And so she went, and when she came back, he wasn't there, and they officially divorced a few years after that. But she was like, it wasn't like I thought of it as risking my relationship with him or risking him not being in your life, because she never thought that as a possibility for a father to decide, yeah, I'm not going to do this. She said, I didn't want to ever lose me. And so that was the decision I made. And yeah, that's how she ended up being a single mother.
Oh, wow. Wow. So how is that story, right? Because like, you said it so, you know, like, look, obviously looking at you and as you tell the story, there's joy in it, right? And how they came together. And there's also like a joy of like pride in your mom choosing herself, right? How has that story impacted you in how you relate and thought of relationships and marriage? Has that had an effect on you? Oh, effect on you?
Yeah. So it took me a while to feel like she made the right decision, because all I could feel was what I didn't have because of what the world said was necessary in either a two-parent household or two people being involved in a child being raised. And so when I was growing up, there are lots of things that happened to me, like including being molested, including us almost getting evicted from a house, including just a lot of hardship where poverty and a lot of other things were concerned. And it took me a while to not hold her responsible for other people's decisions. And so that took a minute. And then where relationships were concerned, I have always been pragmatic to the negative point. So I'm like, yeah, great things are happening right now. The other shoe could drop at any time. And so I never expected anyone to stay, because I'm like, if the person who was supposed to love me unconditionally didn't stay, why would any other person stay? And so though I was in relationships, I don't even know if I can call them relationships, like situationships that I thought were serious, I realized I was never serious psychologically. My emotions and ego were tied to being in a relationship, so that if it didn't work, it was more about embarrassment than anything else. But it took a while. And even when I got married, like, I've known my husband since I was 17. We didn't get married until I was 29. Our first was already 3 years old. And on the day of the wedding, I locked myself in the bathroom of the hotel for like 4 hours, because I was like, this isn't going to work. Why are we doing this? I'm terrified. I won't keep your child from you, but I can't see me being in a marriage that can work, because I never saw it. Him, on the other hand, he's never seen anything other than marriages that could work. So for him, he was like, I'm not going to take you as a challenge, but I'm going to show you that I'm not your father. And hopefully you'll give me the chance to do that. And so far it's been cool.
Yeah. I haven't had the privilege of meeting your husband, but from our time working together and just knowing you, you know, you there's that love. I could see the love, and I could see the family that you're building, and just the intentionality around that. Right. And sometimes it's hard. Like, I think we sometimes want what we didn't have, but because we didn't have it modeled, it's hard for us to actually believe that's possible. And so then the challenge and obstacle becomes really like that faith. It's really having that faith and working through that every day. You know, it's not a one-time thing. It's a constant thing.
It's funny that you say that, because like, I remember it almost like yesterday. I can't even remember where we lived at the time. I think we were still living in Lefrak right before we moved out to Jamaica and St. Albans area. And Jabari, that's the eldest, had just turned 3. And he's playing on the floor and talking to himself and everything and just giggling because he's just happy. And I walk up behind him and I'm looking at him and I'm just staring. And I knew what I was looking at and what I was thinking at the time, but I didn't want to give voice to it. So then Brian comes behind me and he's like, I'm not your father. I know he left at this age. I'm not him. And I need you to believe that, as hard as it might be for you to think that it's possible, but I'm not him. And so that faith that you either made the right decision, or even if you didn't, that it'll still work out, is something that it is a constant practice to believe in the good that should come to you, instead of believing that negativity is what you deserve. And it's almost something that, at least I feel like I was conditioned to believe, because of how I was growing up, but also because of what I internalized from like TV messages and even movies about how life should be. You have these families and everything is solved within 20 something minutes and everybody's happy. And I'm like, that's not my life. Where's my life shown there? And so I figured, if my life isn't being shown, there's something very wrong about this and people shouldn't want to see it.
Yeah, I can see that. Did you ever reconcile your relationship with your father? Like, what happened after? We're going to go more into your mom sending you to Liberia, but I'm curious to know what happened after, you know, your mom comes back, your father is gone, her husband is gone.
So it, I guess it went through different phases. I didn't see him again until I was in second grade. I was 6 years old, and there was a report card night. And so my mom was like, well, he's in the country. He hasn't seen you for a while. He's gonna come here, spend time with you while I go to report card night. I was not a good eater. I'm still not the best eater in the world, but he gave me split pea soup. I hate split pea soup to this day. He made me eat it. I threw up on him and he beat me until I had swelling all over my body. And then he put me into a hot tub to bathe after that. She came, I was screaming, she kicked him out. I didn't see him again until after we came back from Liberia again, because we were in Liberia for a few years before the Christmas Eve 1989 Civil War broke out. When I came back, he'd remarried, even though he'd had another marriage between my mom and this new person that he was married to. And I guess he had an idea that I was supposed to be deferential to her for whatever reason. And I've never been the type of person that just gives deference or respect just because someone is older because of their title. And so I was asking her certain questions and asking him questions about her. I'm like 13, 14. That's like the height of like teenage angst. And so he, because of the way I was speaking to him, because he had nothing but sons and didn't expect that this girl child would have the audacity to speak to him in a certain way, he hauled off and punched me in my eye until my blood vessel burst. And so I literally, in like early fall, late summer, yeah, it was more late summer because school had not yet begun, had to go on a train to my mom's job with a busted eye, telling her what had happened. And again, it was a situation and he was not allowed to come within a certain distance from me. And since that time, he's never apologized for it. He's always acted like it was my fault that he did these things to me. And we've had conversations about it because my, I guess the bad part of theology, when it's saying forgive, like forgive comes after repentance, right? Even with Jesus, like that's what was supposed to happen. And so I was saying, maybe my salvation is tied to this. Maybe things are going wrong in life because I'm not forgiving him. And so I would try and try. And it was almost like a cycle of abuse that I was putting myself into, because every time he would prove himself to be someone who just did not want to be in that type of relationship with me. And it took, honestly, until late last year, when like he recontacted me on Facebook Messenger, and he was trying to do that, let's just bypass everything that happened and let's try to go into something. And then he wrote this really callous letter that again showed who he was. And I was like, okay, thank you for proving to me that there's nothing wrong with me. You don't have the capacity, and I'm okay with that now. It took a long time, but I'm okay with that now. And so I've finally fully cut him off. And I'm okay.
Wow, that was, I can, that's very hard. But at the same time, it's learning to leave the table when love is not being served, right? Like Nina Simone says, and it's hard. It's difficult when it's always, when it's your loved one, when it's somebody you yearn for love and somebody you yearn to have a relationship with, right? And it's difficult because sometimes there is that need to forgive and really see people for who they have become, not who they were, but also recognizing like it's their presence is not good for me, you know? And I think you always, as selfish as it may sound, but I think, you know, you're only responsible for your own happiness. And so putting yourself through situations with somebody that really doesn't bring joy to you, regardless of who they may be to you biologically, makes no sense. It's not that it doesn't make sense, but it's not healthy, right? Because.
But that's where like the guilt came in for years for me, is like, I knew, like you said, the quote from Nina Simone, I knew for decades love wasn't being served. But again, I had this yearning where it's like, what is it about me that would make someone who's supposed to love me, not love me? And why do I have this yearning for this person? Like, do I not love me enough? Like, am I not enough? And then I was like, as many arguments as I get in with my mom, she could have abandoned me too. She didn't do that. Why am I, you know, fighting her? And why am I not understanding that she had a life other than me? And that should have been honored, and that society didn't honor her choices either. Like, society said, in order to be seen as valuable in being a woman, you have to be connected to someone, and you have to, I guess, comport yourself in a way that makes that person more comfortable. And though she did grow up like that in Liberia, where like she had her dad until he passed when she was a teen, and she had her mom and she had uncles, she had siblings, but she's, to this day, she is the oddball of all of them, where she's like, I don't have to do that, and I'm okay. And I need you to be okay with the fact that I'm okay.
And that's not my insecurity, right? And it's sometimes hard. Our insecurity, we may project as theirs, and that's not theirs. Like, they've come to terms with it. And I was recently sharing on Instagram about owning my Fina heritage, right? As growing up, when my father would tell people that he's a storyteller, I'd be like, you know, I'd be embarrassed, right? And I would want to let people know his accolades, right? Because I was like, that's not good enough, right? Because I didn't see the value in that. But those were my insecurities, not necessarily his, right? Just like, that was your mom, that was your insecurity, right? About her choices, not necessarily hers, right? She had come to terms with that. So after your mom decides to go to Liberia to have her community back home, raise you, how old were you?
So we had a couple different times. It was from six, was it? It wasn't even 6 months. It was like 3-4 months until I was 3.5. And then it was summer of fifth grade year. And then it was the end of sixth grade, all of seventh grade, and only half of eighth grade. But everything I am today is because of that time in Liberia. And I cannot wait until the day that my entire family can go and see. And I know it doesn't look the way that it did when I was growing up there, but the idea of excellence not being negotiable, and not to the point where it's like, I'm gonna force you to get these grades, or I'm gonna force you to know this thing. It's more of a, why would you be okay being less than what you're capable of being? And we will agitate you so that you understand that we see talent in you and we see brilliance in you that you may not see in yourself. And our job as your family is to agitate you enough for you to do that. And so that's something that developed in me, but also the understanding of the hypocrisies of family, right? Because the two sides of my Liberian family is what we will call Kunga or Miracle Liberians, and then the country or indigenous people. And so the majority of time, even though I had really good relationship with the indigenous, I didn't know the story enough about them, right? And even though my mom's last name is that last name, but the folks that I guess she got her ways from were more of the Americo-Liberians. So when we lived in Liberia, we had houseboys and housegirls that were my same age. And I always asked the question about it because I was the outsider. I might look like you, like some of the same foods, but I was still the outsider because of my citizenship and because I did live some time in America. And I would always ask about the fairness of someone my same height or my same age working while I was, you know, chilling in the living room or playing or even studying? Or how is it someone who's older than me is in a lower grade than I am? Why is it okay that I get to see my mom every day,
but they don't see their parents until like every other week. And it was those questions that I was asking so that honestly, when the war broke out, I was clear as to why it happened and how it happened. Like all of the wars had everything to do with a belief that where someone's story seemed to start or where they decided to start their story was a problem with someone else. And from that, it made me this person where when I was in high school, I was the person who was like, okay, I might get in trouble for something, but I have to say something about what's happening. Same thing in college, same thing in all of my jobs where it might be comfortable for you, but where are you starting the story? If you say, you know, these people messed up the country, and so we have to take it back from them as Americo-Liberians, you're starting the story with the American Colonization Society. You're not starting the story with the fact that Indigenous people have been on that land before it was ever named Liberia. How dare you tell them they should be over their abuse by now, just because you want to be more comfortable. And I've always been that since then, I've been that person.
It's amazing because now that you've told this story and I know what you do, I'm going to have you share with our listeners what you do. It makes so much sense. Sometimes we don't even know how certain experiences impact our life trajectory and our purpose, right? Like it's those moments. I want to know if there was a particular incident you saw growing up while you were in Liberia that made you really think like, this is really unfair, like something that happened, you know? And then also what you do currently.
So there were two things that happened. One, his name is, I say is because I want to believe he's still here. His name is Zina, and he was reading in what we call his copybook. That's where you would write down your work. And I was in seventh grade already, but he was in second. He was older than I. And so hearing him trying to sound out basic words made zero sense to me. I'm like, this is a person that can cook better than anyone I have ever met, that for some reason is doing laundry and cleaning all over the place. And that's where his talents are being used. But for some reason, his brain isn't being cultivated in the same way simply because of class systems in the country with people that look just like you. And that bugged me because I'm like, I learned that from my grandmother so that I came back to the United States fully reading and I wasn't four yet. And when I say fully reading, I had two picture books in my house growing up. One was the Pokey Little Puppy because it dealt with a really nosy dog. And I've always been nosy. And that's what my mom and grandmother said, like, you just poke all over the place. And The Giving Tree by Shel Silverstein. And the way they taught me it is how I teach it, not the way we usually are taught the book. But those are the only two picture books because I was reading chapter books and Shakespeare and all that other stuff early. So it never made sense to me that if I can do that at that age, what makes it so that he learned to cook, but I didn't learn how to cook. He learned to clean. I didn't learn how to clean. But I learned how to read. He didn't learn how to read. And then there was another instance where it's like a common thing you would do if you're cooking, you drop something and he had to go get his own. It's called a rattan. And he was beaten and then had to clean up the accident that he made in dropping a little bit of food and then cook again. And he was supposed to act like he was okay. But I was also supposed to act like I didn't see it or that was okay to happen. And it was never okay. And I made sure that he knew that, but it's not like I had power to change anything. But I felt like if I can at least tell him I see what happened and I know it's wrong, I don't know why it's happening, but I know it's wrong. And so I feel like that is what I've been doing.
So what is that that you've been doing? I know what it is, but I want you to say it.
So officially for the past 6 years, I've been director of, the title now is Equity and Engagement. And what that is pretty much like having discussions about oppression and how oppression looks, how it can often start with conversations or conversations not being had, stories not being shared, and then how it turns into, well, this is just how things are. And not hearing enough of everyone's story makes it seem like everyone was complicit in either their own abuse or someone else's abuse, instead of understanding how power actually works and how when people are trying to negotiate between actually living and or being, or rather thriving and or being able to pay their next bill, the immediacy of a bill can sometimes cause you to be like, I don't know what else to do. And if this is the only option for me, I'll take it for as long as I possibly can until something better comes. And so I think I got the formalized education in that with one of my college professors with whom I'm still in contact, because he was really big on educational policy. Like, I went into college saying, I'm going to be a lawyer and I'm just going to fight all of the bad people, and that's what's going to happen. And the more I grew, the more I understood that that is part of it, but my blood is education. My mom just retired from being a teacher. My grandmother was a teacher before she passed. Her mother was a teacher. And so it was something I wanted to not do because I was like, they're crazy. But it's in me where that's, to me, where liberation can happen, where you're learning to read so you know what's wrong with what's happening. You grow your mind because nobody can, as long as you're alive, nobody can take what's in your mind away from you. And in that, you create these avenues for how you define thriving for yourself. And it's never been easy because, again, if you do speak up and you have a bill due, you have to ask yourself, not do I shut up, because that's never an option, but how do I tell this story to this person who is hurting someone else so that they feel that you are hurting someone? How does it feel to know that you're the cause for when this person wakes up in the morning, they're like, this is the only option I have. And I'm hoping against hope that this is the last day. Like, what does that make you feel like? I don't think anybody wants to be that person in someone's story. And so I help to give voice to those stories.
That's wonderful. And I've seen you do it so beautifully with children of all ages, you know, and so I had the privilege of working with Workia. We both worked at an independent school together. I was a fundraiser there, and you were an educator and more, right? And I think, you know, that's one thing I'm learning, is that what we do sometimes is bigger than just what the title may be, right? And sometimes it's even healing us and what we've been through and what we've seen in life, right? So part of it, it's maybe you trying to heal that child that saw the abuse that was happening to what was his name? Zina, right? And feeling at the moment powerless, but now you feel like you have power, and how can I use the power that I have now so that something like that doesn't happen or continue to happen? And again, it's like going deeper and understanding our own stories, right? And curiosity about your family story and how does that dynamic play, right? So you were in Liberia at different stages, right? You said three, you said fifth grade, summer fifth grade. What was that, another?
And then the end of sixth grade until eighth grade was over, but I never finished eighth grade because of the war.
How did you feel about being sent? Or that's a particular framing of that, but how of being sent to be raised by your mom's community? Because I assume she remained in the States, like she would go and take you there and then she would remain in the States. How was that, and how have you began to understand that story?
I don't think I was affected by it until we went back together to Liberia after sixth grade, because you're a baby pretty much, and whatever you're given up until that three-year-old period, there's not much you remember. And I was definitely loved. My grandmother, she called me her Afro baby. She had other grandchildren, but I was the only one that she took care of personally. And she spoiled me but to her, it wasn't spoiling. And even when I say it, it sounds wrong coming out of my mouth, but to other people, it was spoiling. Because I don't know what it was with me where food, though I liked food and I liked the idea of watching people cook, I still do that to this day. The eating, if I was eating by myself, I'm not good with that. And there were certain tastes that I would have and I'm like, I don't want to eat any of this. And so she was very okay with me. Like if for a week, all I wanted to do was eat corn, as long as I was eating, I could eat corn. If it was Cap'n Crunch, which often it was, that's what I would eat. Sometimes it was like rice with seasoning and some butter, but she would ease other things into it so that I learned how to eat fufu and soup, and I love it to this day. I learned how to eat cassava leaf and potato greens, and those are still amongst my favorite foods. And with that, she taught me reading, she taught me colors, she taught me math, she taught me the order in which things should be done. And so I didn't recognize that this wasn't what was supposed to actually happen. It wasn't until that summer of fifth grade when it was like the entire summer I'm in Liberia. I'm not seeing my mother every day. There's no FaceTime at that time. I'm not calling her every day because it's super expensive. And I'm like, why is it okay that I'm here without you? And are you okay without me? And if you are, why? So then when I got back, it was like, yeah, I have to listen to you because you're allegedly my parent. But if you're my parent, why do you keep sending me to other continents? Like, what's wrong with a babysitter here? And so that was an issue with me. And then when we were in Liberia and finally the war broke out, the only reason my mom was able to get out because she wasn't a citizen yet was because I was a citizen of the United States. And they're like, well, you have no other person that's been tending to you. So the person who's been taking care of you is who's going to come with you. And so I'm like, oh, so you abandoned me, but now it's my responsibility somehow to get you out of this war-torn country that you loved so much, right? So that was when it started to, it was like, at the same time, I'm learning my father is a crappy individual, and then my mom is this selfish person who just wants to live her own life. And I'm like, and in the middle, I'm here. I didn't ask to be born, and you decided, you know, adoption or abortion was just something you wouldn't do. But then why choose not to parent? And so I started to feel like one parent chose to not be near me. Maybe it was easier to not parent if you don't see me, versus the other parent saw me and chose intermittent times not to parent. So it was still like, again, what is it about me that makes these people make these decisions for themselves when I have no choice in the matter?
I've been on a similar journey. So I think, you know, but my birth parents are not together. And my mom left me in Sierra Leone when I was very, very young, like before I was even one. And so I was raised by my grandparents. And, you know, back home, you do have people, you know, would send their kids back home. Like if like they're struggling, they're sent for their kids to be cared for by their community back home. And so I never understood it as a bad thing until I got older, right? And having part of it's a privilege to have certain language about around it, you know, but then at the same time, you start inflicting feelings that you might have not necessarily felt. So I didn't necessarily at the time feel abandonment. But as I got older, it was like, oh, you know, you start thinking, was I abandoned, you know, and really working through that, because there's things that obviously come out of it, right? Because there's like bonding stuff. But again, reframing that story to a place where it's like, no, she loved me so much that she rather a community care for me and give me a kind of support that she maybe single-handedly couldn't at the time. Retelling it in a different way, right? Because with that comes compassion, with that comes understanding someone's situation. Yes, your mom may have been someone who really wanted her independence and was then had a child and was like, how do I work between my independence, but also give this child something that they deserve, which is love, right? Which is care. Has there been a journey for you in understanding that and reframing that experience?
Big time. So as I got older, and my grandmother would tell me certain things at different stages of my life, because she lived with us for a little while in high school. And then afterwards we would have family reunions or times when I would just see her. And there were stories she told me about her life that she didn't tell anybody else. Like she didn't tell her other grandkids. She definitely didn't tell her children. And I was like, wait a minute. I feel like the golden child because I have all of these instances of a woman, a Liberian woman who was raised to believe something about herself and even about marriage, that when she saw things not working in a particular way, she said to herself, this is what I can control, this is what I can't control. I will work really hard on the things I can control. And when it's time for me to tell my story to whomever I need to, that's what I'll do. And so like she told me a story where, and I can't even remember when this came up. I think it was a time, honestly, she thought I was having sex. I was not, because I was terrified of the idea. And she said, you know, I had four children and I found out your grandfather was doing some things and I got pregnant twice again and I drank blue water and I wasn't pregnant anymore. I was like, did this woman just tell me she had two self-administered abortions to make sure she wasn't continuing to have kids? And I was amazed because I was asking, why are you telling me it? Are you telling me it because you're saying it is an option for me should something happen? Or are you telling me it because you're showing me that who I may have thought you were, you're so much bigger than that, and that there are so many different ways to be even when life is prescribed for you? And I kind of said, okay, maybe she's telling me both. And she was always that person. And she passed away 2 weeks before I had my fourth child, but I got to see her when she was in London. And she was like, I know people are asking why in the world you're having so many children. And I was like, yeah, people are asking. She was like, do they pay your bills? I was like, no. She said, I know you. If you weren't okay with this, you would have stopped at three. So you go and do what you want, and we're here with you. And of course, like she was already saying she's tired. But I told her, no, you promised me you're going to live until you're 100 and we're going to have your party. And she was like, yeah, but I'm getting tired, but we'll always be here with you. And it's like she knew she was leaving, but she also knew I knew she wasn't leaving. And so like, it sounds crazy, but we talk to this day.
And that's something your mom gave you. And that's something, if she hadn't done what she did, you may have never had those that treasured relationship, right? Maybe your relationship with your mom may not be as close as it is with your grandma, but there's somebody in your life that was very, a very precious time.
But now, like my relationship with my mother now, we text and talk all the time, literally every day. And it's weird because I'm her only child. She's my only parent. If I text her and she doesn't respond within 10 minutes, in my head, she's on the ground somewhere and she's fallen and she can't get up. Mind you, she does more exercise than I do. But to me, I'm responsible for her. And she thinks I'm like, why are you always worried about me? And I don't know why, but I get really nervous if she doesn't respond right away.
I could see that. I could see that, you know, because she's your world, right? And you are her world. And in many ways, like if she's on if she's not available to you, what, it's almost like asking yourself, like, who am I without her? And that's scary, you know, in itself. There's several other things I want to talk about, but if you're comfortable, you did mention that when your grandmother was telling you the story, right? And, you know, there was this fear that you really didn't even want to have sex because it was, it scared you. Where did that fear come from?
So when I was 6 years old, again, in second grade, my mom was the principal of a church school. And so education, like I said, has always been really important to her. And so she took this job pretty much like her life. To me, that's what it seemed like. Like that was more important than anything else. And so I would, at 6 years old, have to walk from school across a big old boulevard in order to get to the church school. And so in her head, you know, if this child can read chapter books, she can read, you know, walk, don't walk, and she'll do that properly. And I would come every day, and I had, I guess it was like a schedule or a regimen where I would be in the staircase and I would read books, finish my homework, do all that stuff. But I would first, you know, go say hi to her, go to the staircase, finish my stuff, and then go to her. And I remember sometime during that 6 year old stage, there was someone who was working at the school. And this was before a bunch of background checks and all that other stuff was happening. And this person knew what my regimen was as well. And so I remember how long it lasted, but I don't remember the exact date it started, but I do remember what I was wearing. I was in my school uniform. I was going to a Catholic school, and I had my hair like in two pigtails with red bows. And I'm in the stairwell, and Charlotte's Web was the book that we'd started to read at that time. And books were always, to this day, they're my thing. My bookcases are not, I wish they were neater than they were, but they're overflowing with books. I guess it was that time that I learned to escape using books. And so this guy, for a year and a half, would come into the stairwell and he would stick his finger into my underwear and would dig around and whatnot, take his finger out, smell it, and then go back to work. And while I knew something was wrong, I didn't understand what was happening, why it was happening, and what I could say, because it was literally happening in a church. And so in my head, I'm like, okay, I'm in a church. God is everywhere. If God sees this and God isn't stopping it, then even if I don't feel good about it, maybe it isn't wrong that it's happening. So if I'm saying something, am I saying something against God? And later on, I figured out that I was having, because after the things would happen, and every few months, using the bathroom to urinate was fiery. And I didn't realize, neither did my mother realize, that these were urinary tract infections that I was getting every other month. So you're 6 and then 7 years old, and going to the bathroom to expel waste in the way you're supposed to made you cry. But I would cry in the bathroom by myself. I would literally turn the water on so that whimpering couldn't be heard, because I didn't want to sin. And I felt that telling was a sin, because again, if it's happening in church, it has to be right. And so from that point on, even if I liked a boy, because like I've always been hetero. I do still believe like sexuality can be fluid. But for me, like I've always liked dudes. But I never wanted anything physical past a hug. And if anyone would try, I'd be like, I'm not doing that, because I believe I'm going to go to hell, which again was weird. You get these church messages from a Pentecostal church happening in the same Pentecostal church, that something really wrong is happening that is causing you pain month after month, and you can't say anything, but you're too young to understand how it's happening. And so what I started doing is, like, even if I was doing regular homework, when I would hear him coming into the stairwell, because I didn't know where else to go or what else to do, I would open a book. And while he's doing whatever it is he was doing, I'd read a book. And it was like my body was there, but my mind was somewhere else. And I didn't say anything to anyone about it until I was 16. And then when I finally did have sex, which wasn't until I was almost 21, it was still like only my body was there, but my mind is somewhere else. So it was something that was happening to me instead of me being engaged in it. The first time, and it wasn't like I was going, like, even if I was, like, that doesn't matter, but I was with one person and one person alone. But the first time that sex was more than physical was with my husband. And that freaked me out. And so I was like, oh, this not supposed, like, what is this thing where I'm fully present? It was so overwhelming that I was like, I can't talk to you for a while, because I don't know what just happened and I'm not in control. So we're just going to be friends forever. And so, like, that's how it was, because I always felt like it's a thing that happens to me that I have to endure, not something that I can eventually enjoy and feel like my entire person is being honored. So yeah, it took a while.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. I really appreciate you being so brave and courageous for sharing that, because it's something that I know a lot of people may have experienced, and something that they deal with, you know, privately, and sometimes the shame and also even guilt, like, you know what I mean? And so,
and I think I understand both the shame and the guilt, because again, those are the stories we're told, mm-hmm. about had you done this, then that thing wouldn't happen. And again, I'm still working through a lot. I'm in therapy now. But what I have come to understand is, I'm telling you this story, but I never, ever, ever, ever have to relive that story again. And so the pain that I used to feel with it was because I was still so connected to the smell around me when it happened. So that I, like, when that smell, if I was walking in the street, it would take me right back to it. I've hated the color red for years, so that in the organizations that I'm in, when it's like, you know, wear red for Heart Health Day, I'm like, I'm not wearing red, because I'm remembering the ribbons that were in my hair.
It's triggering and, for you.
Exactly. But it took a while for me to, and it's messages that I had to tell myself, you're not reliving it. You don't have to relive it again. Telling your story frees you. It is something the person who did this to you should feel shame for. It's not something you should feel shame for. And what made that challenging is that as an adult, I was raped, and it was date rape. And I, of course, I'm like, there has to be like a sign, an invisible sign on me somewhere that says, it's cool to hurt her because she's dealt with a lot. She's not going to tell anybody about it anyway. And somehow she's going to be able to live after, and you're going to be okay. And so it's taken a lot to deal with. It's not something that I did. These are decisions other people made that, yes, affected me, but it's not because there's something wrong with me. There's something wrong with them.
I'm just like trying to take that all in. And I just want to say thank you so much to share that, because I know it's not easy, but like you said, it's getting to a place where you can share it because now you don't have to relive it. Do you remember you said at 16 was when you mentioned it to someone, you told someone what had happened. Who was it, and how did you feel when you finally shared that?
I feel like that was when I started to spiral into the, I go to church because I'm afraid to go to hell, but all of this is bull. Because I was, they gave me the verse, Romans 8:28, all things work together for the good of them that love the Lord. And so I'm like, you're telling me that allegedly God could make the world out of nothing, but God couldn't figure out how to teach me things about God's self without sexual abuse? And I'm supposed to be okay with that? So at that point, I was like, I'm gonna be as disruptive as I can be, either in school where I'm asking questions of people who are supposed to have authority, or do the same thing in church. And you're either gonna answer my question or you're gonna be uncomfortable. I'm not gonna be uncomfortable about it anymore. And so then I developed a reputation for being confrontational. And I'm like, I don't feel like it's a confrontation. I ask you a question. Answer the question. If you can't answer the question, say, I can't answer the question, but don't call me confrontational. And so I've still been wrestling with who people have told me God is or God needs or whatnot. And I think that's also part of the equity thing, because I feel like the stories that I was told about God and how people sometimes, or certain Christians, see other religions as like, why would they say that you need a sacrifice? Why would they say you shouldn't eat this? I'm like, do you hear what you're saying about who you say you believe in? You're telling me that makes more sense to you than these other belief systems just because you didn't grow up with them? And so I've not been the type of person to believe that the only way to heaven, if there is one, is through this specific belief system. I don't believe God to be Christian. I don't believe that God speaks English only. I don't believe God cares what we call God. I believe, like my son said years ago, that God cares that we call God, but not what we call God. And I still believe that to this day, which can be, it can be strange if you've grown up with certain traditions. So you're unlearning and relearning, and in that growing in your spirituality, so that it is actually a spiritual connection and not religious habits causing you to do a thing.
No, for sure. And I think I know for myself, I've gone through a journey also of not because any particular bad thing has happened, right? Like things have happened, but more about really understanding for myself, right? And trying to have a relationship with God, not have it be through the lens of anybody else, but through what my experience is and what I want in life, this faith. Like I keep coming back to faith because I think it's bigger than anything we could even describe, right? But this just believe in something greater, right? I think it's so important. I'm curious to know, in your journey as motherhood, you know, having had these experiences, has that helped in any way with this journey? What's motherhood's role in that, if there's any?
So, I love talking about my children so much, but I'll actually start with my first. I always tell him, even though we fight more than anything else now that he's about to be 18, I tell him he saved my life, because before I got pregnant with him, before that was when I'd been raped. And I wasn't diagnosed, but because of how I was behaving and the things I was talking about and writing about, I was depressed. And though I wasn't suicidal, I was also not doing safe things. Like if I went out in the middle of the night, which I would often do, I would walk in the middle of the street. And I'm like, you know, if God's supposed to stop the car, then the car will stop. If not, then I'm going to die. And then when I found out I was pregnant, I was like, this is different. There's something different about this child. And I knew it was a boy. And I'm like, I don't know why I'm having a boy when I have all these issues with folks with penises in the first place. But there was just something about knowing he was there that changed something in my mind, but not in my emotions. So my mind was like, okay, I'm going to live to make sure he never feels like he wasn't wanted or abandoned or anything like that. And so I tell him, he saved my life. And I the name Jabari is what came to me because it means brave. And his middle name is Isaiah because it means prophet. After he came, he told me when I was pregnant with his sibling that came a few years after him. And he was like, there's something in your belly and I don't know what it is. Come to find out I was pregnant. That child, I said, corrected me because he was born at 30 weeks. There's no reason why not only should he be alive, but because of everything that could have been happening, he shouldn't be physically thriving in the way he is. And the reason I say he corrected me is that he was born on the day to the hour that my uncle, who was like my father, passed away. And I remember praying to him, not to God, because I was like, look, I'm not talking to God right now because God's been messing up my life. So I believe, though, you're with God. So I need you to tell God, if you don't make sure this child is okay, whatever people have told me about God, I'm going to say that's a lie and nobody needs to believe. But that was still a change of mind again, because I still had issues with me. Then again, the firstborn told me, there's a girl in your belly and she's supposed to be born in March. Her due date was like March 20 something. She ended up coming about a month earlier because her heart stopped. And so when she was taken out, my husband was holding her and they're sewing me back up. And I hear him say, you are the most beautiful baby girl I've ever seen in my life. And you look just like your mom. Now, I was in my mid-30s. And that was the first time I believed myself to be beautiful, because I'd seen my daughter. And I thought that she is like a doll that came out. And I'm like, I don't see how this being is related to me, because she's pure and beautiful and so much hope. And hearing him say that, I was like, I'm beautiful. And on the one hand, it made me happy. Then it made me upset again, because I'm always analytical. I'm like, why didn't I believe I was beautiful before a man said something? But she kind of like, that course corrected me in a way, because I'm like, there's something about you. And I didn't take meds, even though I was in pain, because I'm like, I don't want anything to happen to her. So don't give me any pain medicine, which was wrong, because I'm like, why am I going through pain unnecessarily? And then the last one, again, my eldest tells me this is the last one, and he's going to be born between this day and this day. And the last day that he said was when actually his birthday is. But they all of their names came in dreams, and all of their names have meaning that is, it's like, I can't remember the, I think is Shire is her last name. And she said, give your daughters heavy names. But in my head, it was like, give your children heavy names. So like I said, the first one is Jabari, which means brave. The second one, even though he was born looking anything but this, his name is Kamani, which means king. Zaria means lightning shower. And then Ajani, the last one, means one who has won the thing for which he has struggled. And I feel like they all are that part of my growth. And I feel blessed every day that I guess God would risk me being in their lives so that they can heal me, and I can also help them it's not even like be better than me or be better than their dad, but to be who they're supposed to be, even if it isn't whom I'm comfortable with them being, because it's their life. It's not my life, just like it was my mom's life, not my life. And so I think getting to understand that makes me a different parent.
Oh, so beautiful. So beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. And it's incredible that your son had the foresight about all of his siblings.
But not with Lotto. I'm like, you just do this with your siblings? Come on, give me some numbers.
Well, it's beautiful, you know, and I'm glad that, you know, their presence in your life has helped you know yourself, love yourself, and honor your own story and journey. Because that's what life is about, you know. It's a process, you know. I've just enjoyed this conversation so much, Workia, and I think that's what the power of story is, right? It's like when we tell our stories, we understand and see things. Like I'm having like revelations about my own personal experiences and seeing them in a different way, right? And I think that's so important, constantly giving ourselves the opportunity to re-examine how we see the world and understand the world, and hopefully even love ourselves and have a better self-knowledge, because I think that's our superpower is our self-knowledge. So thank you for that opportunity for me, because like now I'm just like, oh wow, what a beautiful way to start my Sunday.
Thank you, because you like thinking about just when we did work together, yeah. There's and I think there's a reason why you were so successful where fundraising is concerned. Yeah. I feel like this is similar, because you have to be able to tell the story of your organization, mm-hmm. but you have to be able to hear the stories of the people who you're wanting to contribute to the organization. So my hope for you is that in this year, the stories that you illuminate helps you to illuminate your story as well. Yeah. I hope that advertising comes to you in ways where you might have to turn people away, yeah. for 1 week because you have something else happening. Because like for me, this was church. Like I'm going upstairs to watch it, but this was church. And yeah. Thank you.
Is there anything else you want to share? Because I think it's always important for people to maybe give their last words or something, you know, that maybe they haven't shared. It didn't come to them while they were telling their story, but at the moment they would like to share. So if there's anything.
I guess healing doesn't take place even on your timetable, much less anybody else's. And there will be times when you will feel, I'm good. And then out of nowhere, something will just take you right back to that space where you're not as well comported as you usually present yourself. And sometimes you start wondering, am I not being honest with other people? Am I wearing this mask? And you should tell yourself, yes, I'm wearing a mask. We all wear the mask. And we make the decision as to when the mask becomes too heavy, and then we'll choose to take it off. So I say still choose yourself.
Okay, thank you. I think that's beautiful. I'm learning to choose myself, and that's a journey. But thank you for that, Workia. I really have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and I'm confident that it will resonate with someone, or resonate with many people, you know, aspects of it and stuff. But thank you. Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye.
Hey, y'all. Thank you for tuning in. Please remember to subscribe, leave a review, and share the episode. Be sure to also follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Turning Point Diaries. Kume, until next time.
Theme music by Exile Dynamics featuring More Box.